I gave no thought to wisdom. It all but vanished in the haze. This fragile hand of fortune had changed and turned it all to gray. In secret rooms where we can spy the clearest dreams we walked along.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
From the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, this is Democracy Now!
It is our position as President's counsel that the President was at all time acting under his constitutional authority, under his legal authority, in our national interest, and pursuant to his oath of office.
In the historic impeachment trial, President Trump's lawyers defend his actions as calls mount for the Senate to allow witnesses, including John Bolton, to testify. We'll get the latest. Then to Mexico, where the assassination of a beloved feminist artist has refocused the spotlight on the painful legacy of femicide and violence against women in the border city of Juarez.
She would go out on the streets to protest femicides, women going missing, and the trafficking of women in this city and on Saturday evening. She was murdered with a gun, and right now we are demanding justice as she once did for other women when she was alive.
And we speak to the world-renowned Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei here at Sundance. His new film, Vivos, looks at the story of the 43 Mexican students who disappeared in 2014 after they were brutally attacked and abducted in Iguala, Mexico. They haven't been seen since.
I realize in the world, many cases may look different, but it has similar condition because the truth never comes out. And then what I concerned is not just what happened, but what really happened is when someone never comes back home.
We'll also speak with Ai Weiwei about the protests in Hong Kong and China's crackdown on the Muslim population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's legal team is concluding its defense in Trump's Senate impeachment trial today as the explosive revelations from former National Security Advisor John Bolton's leaked manuscript continue to rock Capitol Hill. On Monday, Trump lawyer Alan Dershowitz argued Bolton's claim that Trump conditioned military aid to Ukraine on investigations into Democrats, including Trump's political rival Joe Biden, does not constitute an impeachable offense, even if true. Republican Utah Senator Mitt Romney told reporters it was increasingly likely that he and at least three other Republicans would side with Democrats to vote in favor of calling witnesses to testify. John Bolton has said he would answer questions before the Senate if he's subpoenaed. Another member of Trump's legal team, Ken Starr, whose investigation led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton, warned impeaching Trump would be too divisive.
Like war, impeachment is hell. or at least presidential impeachment, is hell. Those of us who lived through the Clinton impeachment, including members of this body, full well understand that a presidential impeachment is tantamount to domestic war.
We'll have more on the impeachment of President Trump after headlines with University of Pennsylvania professor Claire Finkelstein. President Trump's unveiling his so-called Middle East peace plan today amidst his Senate impeachment trial. He's expected to introduce it alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner developed the plan, which will reportedly offer conditional sovereignty to Palestinians and remap the borders of the occupied West Bank to give more control to Israel, among other proposals. Prime Minister Netanyahu and his political challenger, Benny Gantz, met with Trump Monday to hear details of the plan. Palestinians have rejected Trump's plan. This is Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh.
This plan does not provide the occupied land to its people, and that does not recognize the borders of 1967, and does not recognize that Jerusalem is an occupied land, and provides it to Israel as a capital. And the plan's creators launch a financial war against us on the UNRWA, and close the office of Palestine in Washington, and dries the financial resources of the Palestinian Authority. It's nothing but a plan to liquidate the Palestinian issue, and we reject it.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu said today he's withdrawing his request for immunity from prosecution over corruption charges he faces back in Israel. He's charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. He's expected to be standing with President Trump when Trump releases the so-called Middle East peace plan. The Supreme Court voted 5-4 Monday to allow Trump's so-called public charge rule to take effect. The vote lifts a prior injunction blocking the measure while it's being challenged in the courts. The hardline immigration rule penalizes documented low-income immigrants who may seek benefits, including Medicaid, food stamps, and housing vouchers, by allowing officials to deny green cards and visa applications to those individuals. Javier Valdez of Make the Road New York said, quote, "This decision will hurt immigrant communities. The Trump administration's public charge rules attack our loved ones and neighbors by imposing a racist wealth test on the immigration system. We'll continue our fight in the courts to stop this reckless policy in its tracks," he said. In more immigration news, House Democrats say they'll soon consider the No Ban Act, which seeks to overturn Trump's Muslim travel ban. Trump said last week he plans to expand the travel ban and will announce additional countries soon. An appeals court in Virginia, meanwhile, is set to hear arguments today in three cases challenging the travel ban. The State Department's removed a veteran NPR reporter from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's upcoming trip after clashing with another NPR reporter last week. Michelle Kellerman was part of the press pool accompanying Pompeo to several Central Asian and European countries, including Ukraine. On Friday, Pompeo was interviewed on the program All Things Considered by Mary Louise Kelly, who pressed him over the treatment of recalled U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
I have defended every State Department official. We've built a great team. The team that works here is doing amazing work around the world.
Sir, respectfully, where have you defended Marie Yovanovitch?
I've defended every single person on this team. I've done what's right for every single person on this team.
Can you point me toward your remarks where you have defended Marie Yovanovitch?
I've said all I'm going to say today.
After the tense interview, Kelly said Pompeo called her into another room and shouted at her for asking him about Ukraine, asked her, quote, "Do you think Americans care about Ukraine?" using the F word and that in other sentences, and demanded she identify Ukraine on a map. In a statement, Pompeo said Kelly lied to him about the questions she would ask in the interview, as well as about their post-interview exchange being off the record. Kelly denies both of these claims. Ben Wisner of the ACLU said of the incident, quote, "The State Department cannot retaliate against a news outlet because one of its reporters asked tough questions. It's the job of reporters to ask the tough questions, not be polite company." In more media news, the Washington Post is under fire after it suspended a reporter for tweeting about a rape allegation against basketball superstar Kobe Bryant. who died Sunday in a helicopter crash that also killed his 13-year-old daughter Gigi and seven others. Felicia Somes posted a link to the Daily Beast article about the 2003 sexual assault allegation against Bryant, which was met with immediate backlash by other users. In a now-deleted post, Somes wrote in response to the criticism, quote, "Any public figure is worth remembering in their totality, even if that public figure is beloved and that totality unsettling. That folks are responding with rage and threats toward me, someone who didn't even write the piece but found it well reported, speaks volumes about the pressure people come under to stay silent in these cases," she said. The Washington Post's own media reporter and the Washington Post Guild both condemned the move to put Somes on leave. In Afghanistan, an American military plane crashed Monday in the eastern province of Ghazni, in an area largely controlled by the Taliban. The Taliban claim they brought down the plane, but U.S. officials say the crash was not caused by enemy fire. The number of people who've been on board the plane has not been confirmed. Elsewhere in Afghanistan, the government air raids in northern Balkh province killed at least seven civilians Sunday, according to local reports. And on Monday, at least 11 officers were killed after Taliban fighters stormed a police base in Baghlan province. In Brazil, record-breaking rains and widespread floods have killed at least 46 people and displaced tens of thousands in the southeastern state of Minas Gerais and the surrounding area. This comes exactly 1 year after the collapse of a mining dam in the region that killed over 250 people and devastated the surrounding land and waterways in one of the world's worst recorded mining disasters. Mining giant Vale is facing environmental charges for the dam's collapse, and its former CEO and 15 others are facing murder charges. In Nigeria, journalist Maxwell Nashan has been killed in the eastern state of Adamawa. He was a reporter and newscaster with the Federal Radio Corporation of Nigeria. The Committee to Protect Journalists is calling for an investigation to determine whether his journalism was the motive for his assassination. Back in the United States, former production assistant Miriam Healy testified to a New York City jury that disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein raped her in his Manhattan apartment in the summer of 2006. She's the second woman to testify against Weinstein in his rape trial in New York, where he's facing life in prison. In a separate case, the United States attorney in Manhattan is criticizing Prince Andrew for refusing to help prosecutors investigate sex trafficking allegations against the late serial sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein, despite Prince Andrew having promised to do so. Prince Andrew was a close friend of Epstein's. One woman, Virginia Roberts Giuffre, has also accused Prince Andrew of being involved in Epstein's alleged sex trafficking scheme, saying she was sexually trafficked by Epstein and forced to have sex with the prince when she was 17 years old. In a BBC interview last year, Prince Andrew denied this allegation and said he did not regret his friendship with a billionaire convicted pedophile who died in a prison cell in August. And in Seattle, Washington, thousands of nurses and caregivers at the Swedish Providence Medical Center are launching a three-day strike today to demand fair wages, adequate staffing, and better conditions for patients. It's part of a statewide strike against corporate giant Providence Health and Services, which healthcare workers say prioritizes profits over patient care. With up to 13,000 workers poised to walk off the job this week, union leaders say it could be the largest healthcare strike in recent history. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Park City, Utah. The president has done nothing wrong. That was the message President Trump's lawyers repeatedly voiced during 8 hours of oral arguments at the president's impeachment trial in the Senate Monday. But Trump's legal team largely ignored the explosive revelations made by Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton. On Sunday night, the New York Times published details about a draft of Bolton's forthcoming book where he claims President Trump personally told him in August he wanted to maintain a freeze on $391 million in military aid to Ukraine until Ukraine turned over materials related to former Vice President Joe Biden and supporters of Hillary Clinton in Ukraine. Biden is Trump's political rival for president. Bolton sent a copy of the manuscript to the White House December 30th for review. The withholding of congressionally approved military aid to Ukraine is at the center of the impeachment trial. On Monday, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Mitt Romney of Utah said the Bolton revelations underscore their case for allowing witnesses to testify.
I think it's important to be able to hear from John Bolton for us to be able to make an impartial judgment.
On Monday, the president's legal case was made by a team of lawyers, including retired Harvard University law professor Alan Dershowitz and former independent counsel Kenneth Starr, whose probe led to the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. During oral arguments, Starr referenced the Clinton impeachment trial.
The nation's most recent experience, the Clinton impeachment, even though severely and roundly criticized, charged crimes. These are crimes proven in the crucible of the House of Representatives debate beyond any reasonable observer's doubt. So too, the Nixon impeachment. The articles charged crimes. Were crimes alleged in the articles in the common law of presidential impeachment? In Nixon, yes. In Clinton, yes. Here, no.
President Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, accused Democrats of lowering the bar for impeachment.
We live in a constitutional republic where you have deep policy concerns and deep differences. That should not be the basis of an impeachment. If the bar of impeachment has now reached that level, then for the sake of the republic, the danger that puts not just this body, but our entire constitutional framework in is unmanageable. Are we going to have every time there's a policy difference of significance or an approach difference of significance about a policy, we're going to start an impeachment proceeding? But you know, as I said earlier,
hello, and this good afternoon. This is Betty Daniels from Impact Fourth Tuesday, and I want to thank my previous Marcy for kind of covering for me while I was kind of like in the lurch there. In the studio, we have Glenn Lewis with us, who is Gwen. I'm going to let you give your title specifically because I have a way of doing things, and right now my technical things got me going. Okay, so here's Gwen Lewis, and she's going to tell you about who she is and what she does.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Gwendolyn Lewis, but when saying Gwen Lewis, I'm saying they call me Miss Gwen. We're talking about interactive storytelling. Interactive storytelling is not just opening a book, turning the pages, learning to read upside down. It is interactive storytelling, where I have the young people or older or the audience just participate by clapping their hands, nodding their heads together, continuing their talking, continuing repeating after me, and just being pulling the audience together. This is important. Not everybody can look at the book. Not everybody will accept reading upside down, as I say. If you're too far, how can you get involved with the story? If you're sitting close, you're the only ones who'll be able to see. However, if you have an interactive storyteller, that person will be so dramatic that the person at the rear of the room will not only hear, but become involved in storytelling. Interactive storytelling is something that I've heard the word drama, interactive storytelling. is basically not using a book. Now, the interactive storyteller will have props, many, many props, or even use themselves or herself as the speaker. And from that, the interactive storyteller will proceed. Now, sitting here, the only thing I just described was what a storyteller is, an interactive storyteller, introducing myself. That's what we've been doing right now. But what we have here as my co-storyteller is Ms. Cheryl Odom. She is going to be a part of the program today.
Okay. All right. The ladies right here are really being very, very helpful with us. And this is Betty Daniels again. I want to thank them both for showing up and being with us. So I guess Gwen, I was kind of had to step out of the office. Did you kind of like let the people know about what the program, what the storytelling is, and different kinds of things like that, or did you give them a story?
Betty, what I did was go through what an interactive storyteller is.
Okay.
Which is different than a regular storyteller. That's what I was doing.
All right. So now what we're also going to ask, one of my questions is that when people say storytelling, you know, right now we got a whole lot of things going on about commercial things. Everybody says, tell a story. What is the distinction about what you do as opposed to this commercial kind of thing? You know, kind of like to get the distinction of what your storytelling is and how that's distinct from other types of storytelling.
Well, I'm going to respond to that. This is Cheryl Odom, and I'm going to take up the next segment as we talk about storytelling. I'm probably between Ms. Lewis and myself, I've got less time telling stories. But what I found in the time that I've been telling stories under her tutelage, I found that storytelling has changed so much for me. Initially, I thought, tell a great story, get kids interacting, get adults interacting in what you're doing, and all is well. But what I found, storytelling is something unique unto itself. It's an opportunity to change people, to change lives, to change minds. I've had to find out the hard way that you just don't get up and tell a story. You have to be prepared. Even if you know a story very well, there are circumstances that can occur in the telling of the story that can change it from what you really intended.
Okay. Can you ladies kind of share with me what that means when you're saying the preparation? What's the preparation for storytelling?
I'll start. Now, Betty, preparation for storytelling is first knowing what a person, the audience, wants.
Mm-hmm.
It can be they want a humorous story. They may want a serious story. However, preparation goes as far, well, it's not the audience. It goes far back as preparing yourself for confidence to speak. That's okay. How far back storytelling comes.
Okay, now, back in the day, I was told that storytelling was part of the oral history. That's where the original storytellers mm-hmm. came from. Is that part of something that you know? Is that something... Like we say, you have to know what the person wants. So do you incorporate your audience and what they need and where they're coming from and what you prepare for a story for them?
Yes. If I understand correctly, how do I give them what they want?
Yes. I guess my thing is this, is that sometimes people don't necessarily want to hear, you know, it's like, I'll tell you what you want to hear and that kind of thing. Well, I already know what I want to hear. Give me something new. Okay, so where's the inner, you know, where is you... Okay, let me try and make see if I'm making it clear to you. Humor. Okay, I might be used to one kind of humor. So if I tell you I'm used to that kind of humor and then you give it back to me, that may or may not be, you know, add to my thing. So is storytelling, kind of how would you address that kind of situation? Or did I make myself clear enough?
Well, there's different ways to answer that. So,
okay.
We'll go with that.
Okay.
Storytelling, as you say, is an oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And as you share stories, you may share personal stories. You may share stories from books.
Mm-hmm.
And you may share, like you said, a humorous story. And as you share it, you study the background of that story, and you try to go from the background, from what someone is asking for, to preparing yourself mentally, physically, and emotionally for the story. And then you go and share the story. Do you see something different in what she's asking?
I think that what I'm hearing is when we prepare for a story, there are a number of elements. The first is who's asking you to tell the story. What do they want from you? And oftentimes they are very specific. It's age group four to five.
Yeah, okay. All right.
It's age group four to five. It's seniors. It could be children who are developmentally or emotionally have some issues. And so based on the needs or the desires of the person who have asked you to come in, you tailor what it is that you're doing to meet their needs. Now, no two storytellers are alike. What directs me is the oral history. It's important that culture is a part of what I do. I don't tell a lot of stories. I tell more personal stories. I tell stories that are folk tales, which means that it's not owned by anyone. It has a script, but it can be altered. So there are, depending on where you are and who you are, there are storytellers who do enactments.
Okay.
They will be Harriet Tubman.
Okay.
They will dress. They will do the whole thing. I don't do that.
Okay.
So if they're looking for someone to do that, then we send our experts in that area out.
Okay, all right, okay. And now you're getting to another question that I had about, are there different genres of storytelling? And I think that...
That's okay. Where we talked about the
okay.
interactive.
Okay.
You mm-hmm. talked about the reenactment of a person,
mm-hmm.
of a character. You're
mm-hmm.
talking about folk tales, fairy tales, biographies.
Okay. Can you give me samples of the different types?
Okay. For a folk tale, I can think of the story, The Monkey's Heart.
Okay. I give us the monkey's heart.
Okay. As the story starts off, the monkey and quite a few of the animals are sitting around. They're hungry and they are tired. But they are wondering why the lion, who is the director, is not giving them and sharing with them the fruits that they need. They are hungry. Well, the slow turtle comes in and he shares that he knows where it is. And all the characters are running around to that fruit tree to nourish themselves. The story goes that the giraffe finds it, the magic fruit tree. And the story goes on in whichever way we want to sway it, that the monkey is the one who learns the lesson that you should be careful and kind to other people. You should be kind to your friend. And that's a folk tale that can be switched and changed whatever you want. Then you have, and then Cheryl may have a folk tale you would need to share or a different type of story.
Well, as we said, in a folk tale, it has its own base. So if I did The Lion and the Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
The Lion and the Mouse is a story that most people know, but I put my own twist to it so that I make it interesting first to me so that I can convey it to the audience.
Okay.
So in my interpretation of The Lion and the Mouse, I've given them names.
Okay.
And the mouse's name is actually Itty Bitty. And Itty Bitty is truly a character. And Itty Bitty has decided on a particular day that he is not going to run away when the lion shows up. He's decided that though he's small, he's still smart and he still has rights, and the lion doesn't get to control him. So on this particular day, when the lion comes through, all of the animals were scurrying as they typically do. Well, itty bitty, he hid. And as the lion went through, itty bitty is laughing and kicking his heels up, and he's acting out, and the animals are saying, "Oh my gosh, you can't do this. Get over here, he's gonna get you." And itty bitty is just laughing and kicking up his legs, and the lion makes it over to his favorite tree, and he plops down. Oh yeah, he's the king. The birds are flying, everybody's getting out of his way. And so itty bitty is really acting up this particular day. So he goes over and he crawls up on the lion. Lion's asleep, or sort of chillaxing, as we say. And the lion is laying there, and he's not aware that itty bitty has started to crawl up and the other animals are going berserk. And he gets up on the lion's nose. And he sits there and he's making these gyrations and he's having a great old time when one of those eyes open up on the lion. He's looking at this mouse. What in the world? So he watches him for a moment. Oh, itty is into it. Well, the lion opens both eyes and he looks at this, well, we won't call him a fool, but he wasn't being very smart. Well, the lion does a half roar. Itty freezes. Oh my gosh, what have I done? I'm acting out. And there we are. Do you want it all?
Okay, okay. All right. And my listening audience, you're missing the part of her motions. There's a nonverbal thing that's going on, okay? Mm-hmm. And
that's needed. That is what interactive storytelling.
Okay.
They can see from our face. They can see from our movement of our hands and bodies.
From our voice.
All right.
And voice.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Of what is supposed to be there. Using their imagination is the key.
And I think there's a lot about what we don't do now. Yes, visuals are very, very nice and all that kind of good stuff. Mm-hmm. But the imagination can draw pictures and paint colors that... and everybody's picture is different. So my shade of green is different than your shade of green.
That's right.
And all that other time thing. And I think that's what makes it more personal with the storytelling.
Right.
And that's the interactive part.
Yes.
Is that you've given them the tools
to
draw an imaginary picture.
And they on their experiences as well. Many people my age, in their 60s, remember a time when their parents simply had to look at them in a certain way. And they knew to alter their behavior. Or they knew that they had been given permission to step up and do something. So we use everything that we know, that we've learned, and what we feel to convey the story to the audience.
All right, I'm going to do a little step to another parallel concern here. You two ladies have different backgrounds, right?
Yes.
Or both your teachers, or both your different?
We have different backgrounds.
Okay, all right. So we'll start with, I'm going to start with you first, all right?
Okay.
How did you get into storytelling?
I think I've always been a storyteller. I've enjoyed the use of words, making sentences, creating excitement in my voice, and people have responded to it. My background is I was an administrator at Share House in Detroit. Ran their women's programs, their men's programs for those who are recovering from drug and alcohol and mental health issues. And so when you're dealing with a group like this and you stand up before them to convey a thought or talk about recovery and addiction, they're a tough audience, and so you have to sometimes embellish what you're telling them to hold their attention. And so I learned for 40 years of doing that work, that you are on Front Street every time you go into a group, and you better come correct.
So you've been on stage for a long time.
I've been on stage for a very long time. And that's part of my work. I've taught on the college level as well, and I love to write. So it's just using everything
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Gwenna, what about yourself?
Okay, mine is a little different, but about the same. My education was I was in education, 38 years in the Detroit public school system. From a media specialist librarian, administrator, test coordinator. However, I always wanted to enjoy being out there, on stage. Mm-hmm. At one point, I wanted to be a radio television announcer. So, and once I retired, I decided, well, I'm not going to go into that. What else? But still having the love of literacy, still having read to young people, I learned to read upside down very well. However, even as a storyteller then, as a media specialist librarian, was not the same as being a storyteller, mm-hmm. Interactive storyteller. Mm-hmm. And it's still taking me a while to just constantly learn the appropriate ways to act, how deep you go into your use of props, how deep you go into your presentation. And finding my first organization I found was the Detroit Association of Black Storytellers.
Okay.
I didn't find it. I joined it.
Okay.
And in that, looking at them stand and reenact characters drew me to the organization.
Okay.
The second organization I joined is Detroit Story League. And that also helped me, and it helped many others to be accomplished or learning storytellers.
All right. Now, did you then also get some additional training? Like, right, so you joined these particular organizations. I guess that kind of like I'll use the word support group coming mm-hmm, from substance. Mm-hmm. Was that? Excuse me.
You not only have, I think you're asking what goes on in the for programs.
I'm asking now in the education part, mm-hmm. Can somebody go to school to be a storyteller, or is it something that you have to be a part of these groups where they you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of like a hands-on learning type of situation?
Now, they do have academic storytelling in the colleges and universities. Okay. And I've seen where you can receive a degree, certificate, and degree in storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are those who have so much to share that they join the organizations, network with the members, go to workshops, many mm-hmm. workshops, conferences,
okay. All right.
And be very articulate storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many avenues, but a lot of people join because it has been part of their lives, most of their life,
mm-hmm.
just as Cheryl has shared mm-hmm. when she was, as life has gone on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what the other part of that is, so often when you go to these organizations, you just become members, and it's not this organization, not Detroit Association of Black Storytellers, nor the Detroit Story League. There's a learning component that goes along with everything we do. We talk about dress. We talk about how to groom. We talk about how to eat leading up to, that you keep yourself hydrated. There's so many pieces, even how to have a separate group of clothing that you don't wear for anything else. It's only for your storytelling, and you keep it maintained. So there's all these do's and don'ts.
And is that also then specific to the storyteller?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Because for me, I'm one of those people who I've got an imagination at all kinds of places. So mm-hmm. if you come up with too much props, that takes away from me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it's like I want to see you do it. Like you see, as the radio audience, they can see I'm talking with my hands.
Mm-hmm. And she's really doing it. Blinding me.
Yeah. I'm about to smack my people. So, that gets into age groups. Now, when you're dealing with people who are, say, in the mid-30s, 30 to 40, is there a different approach for them as opposed to someone who is, you know, got a little gray in the hair and stuff mm-hmm. like that? Or is it how it is?
You know, Cheryl, when someone requests you,
you asked what age group you were, and the topic. Mm-hmm. And their topic is generally age appropriate.
Okay.
And you do you get your research going and you tailor it to the group.
Okay.
Or if it's a holiday, if it's a family reunion, if it's graduation, you tailor it to the group. Mm-hmm. And even with seniors, I've learned from that there's a little bit more upbeat, mm-hmm. Singing, involving them, being not touchy-feely, but interactive, more interactive.
Taking them down memory lane.
That's true.
Okay. Okay.
They'll
okay.
bust out a song that reminds mm-hmm. them of something based on, mm-hmm. on what you're telling in your story.
So. All right. Mm-hmm. Generally, how long does the story last? Do you, like, if you had an audience say, oh, I'm going to use that same age group, between the 30, you know, late 20s, late 30s, I guess some of the problems, I'm having a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. How long is a story? And then when you're doing with that age group, do you have to kind of like see how it's going and then you can like put something else in there? You know, like you're reading your audience, that type of thing. Does some of that go on and how do you approach that?
Mm-hmm. They request, like we mentioned, they request mm-hmm. the time that you, maybe they want a 7 minute, giving you 7 minutes. Maybe they're giving you 15 minutes.
Okay.
Within that, you work with them. You okay. and be respectful of working with them.
All right.
However, you ask what happens. You walk in, and they say they're 35-year-old, and you notice there's a lot of kids in there, mm-hmm. or they're 20, or all of a sudden they say they have a lot of time, and they want you for 25 minutes instead of 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you, with more experience and practice, you start having a list of stories, and you start learning how to accommodate the audience.
All right.
And did you have?
Go ahead.
No, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Cheryl, and I'm putting them on the. I did that. They weren't prepared for this. Let's say, do you have something that you could give me that you might have for a person who's like 30 in that audience group? A story that you can share with us, Cheryl.
Well. It depends on the venue.
Okay, right now. I'm going to give you a venue.
Okay.
Okay, or better yet, maybe you can kind of like think about your time when you had an age group like that, mm-hmm. but a story you might have shared with them. Can you, either one of you in that age group?
Mm-hmm. I shared a story with a group of women in treatment. They had been sharing that day. There had been a lot of tears. And so they ask if I would tell a story. You know, somehow or another, they want to make sure I'm human and that I've gone through things in my life as well. I never want to put a burden on a client, so I would never give them anything that was too heavy for them. But I told a story about joining a group and having an opportunity to get a stipend from this group, from participating in. I cast a check, and I had an opportunity to get on the Grand River bus and go downtown. And all I wanted to do was go to one of my favorite places, Quickie Donuts. Listen, Quickie Donuts back in the day had a lemon-filled donut with lemon icing on the very top of it. All I could think of was that donut and getting me a little carton of milk and just sort of chilling and watching people. I love the people watch. Well, on this particular day, I get my donut, I got my milk, and I'm getting myself all situated to enjoy it, and I feel there's someone watching me. And I look over, and there's a man walking towards me. All I could think is, no, he's not going to come over here now when I'm here trying to eat my favorite donut. So he comes over, I wait for him, and he walks over, and as he's walking towards me, I said, ooh, he's sort of good looking. Oh, wow. I mean, he had the look. And so I looked at, he had on a black turtleneck, he had on a black jacket. I mean, he was looking like a panther for real. And so there we were, eyeing each other as he walked over, but I didn't tell you, I was only 15 years old. He was a grown man. So I figured whatever it was, it was directions or something. Well, he walked over and he said, "Is anyone sitting there next to you?" And I said, "No." And I'm looking at this whole place is empty. Why does he want to sit right up next to me? And now my milk is sweating because it's not staying cold. And I want my donut. I want him to go away, is what I thought. And so he turned to me and he said, "So what brings you here?" And I said, "Well, I'm having my donut and my milk." And he said, "Well, I was wondering if you'd like to go to the show." And I said, "I don't even know you." "No, I don't want to go to the show." And he said, "Well, tell me something about you." And I don't know why this man would not leave me alone or why I wouldn't get up and leave. But I looked at him. He was so close to me. He had heavy black eyebrows and a beautiful afro. He smelled so good. I don't know what the cologne was. It was something, but my donut was calling my name. "Will this man please get up out of here?" And he said, "Well, you look like you've been raised right. Tell me about your parents." And I said, "Well, you know, my parents told me not to talk to strangers." And I just wanted him to go. And he took his hand out and he put it under my chin and he lifted it up so that we were eye level. And he said, "You keep doing what your parents tell you to do. You're a good girl. You take care of yourself now. And here's some money to get you another donut." And he walked away.
Okay.
And I thought about him many times since.
Oh, my goodness. I was getting ready to clap, but okay. All right. Well, okay, now, when you are doing it for educational purposes, mm-hmm. okay, is there a different approach, a different type of story, helping to understand it? Mm.
Right now, we're approaching Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And as the schools caught contact, mm-hmm. they may say they want someone. Then the next thing you say, is it a class or is it an audience, the whole school? Mm-hmm. And they tell you, a lot of times, they don't know what.
Right.
And it's good that we could share with them to educate the whoever is hiring us or want us there mm-hmm. to lead them around the correct path so next time no one take advantage of them or that we educating them for education. We already know it's a K through 5 school or a 3 through 5 or a high school.
Okay.
From our stories that we have learned, prepared, we just know that we're going to go there. We tell them what we want, maybe a table, mm-hmm. maybe just a chair. Mm-hmm. And I play the drums, so I always ask for a chair. Otherwise, they give us free range.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you education kind of thing is, let's say that... you have, okay, let me backtrack, because my brain moves that way. One of the questions I asked you earlier when we started talking is that in sales and all this other kind of stuff, they say, tell a story. Have you ever had a situation, and if you haven't had the situation, how would you approach this, where you have a business person says, "I want to teach my people how to tell a story." And really what they're doing is trying to sell them something, okay? But they want them to learn that storytelling technique. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had experience like that? And if you haven't, how would you approach something like that?
I have had an experience like that. And what we're taught in the courses that we take, we're taught that you meet the demands as they present themselves.
Okay.
So what may happen is we will teach them that everyone has a story to tell.
All right.
Some of them don't think so. So what we may do is throw out a set of what we call hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question. And the person is supposed to tell a story based on the hook. So let's say the hook is something my parents never knew I did.
Okay.
And you're going to
cover a lot of territory.
That comes a lot of territory. And how did I change someone's mind who thought ill of me, who didn't particularly care for me? How did I navigate that. And so you give them these hooks, and that is the way to get them to begin to draw stories out.
Okay.
And through the hooks, stories I've forgotten, situations that have happened in my life, I had forgotten about or threw in the background because I didn't want to think about it, and you have a hook that brings it all out again.
Okay. Did you have anything, Gwen? What about yourself?
Okay.
Okay, good. Okay, all right. Now, is there, do you see yourself as being different from a public speaker when you say storytelling, or do you see them as the same or what? Like, you know, yeah. A motivational speaker or those sort of things. Okay, what's the distinction?
When you start sharing, someone said they would like for you to share some stories. They may give you 15 minutes. Mm. They give you the theme. Now, 15 minutes of a one long story, that may take too taxing for the audience, too.
Uh-huh.
But you can be a speaker interjecting several stories within your presentation.
Okay, okay.
A lady I was talking to her last night. She says she would like a storyteller. I mentioned 15 minutes. 10 minutes, that's a storyteller.
She did the same thing to me, folks. Okay.
But if you're talking about a half an hour, you're saying you want a speaker.
Okay.
So even, and if you, we can be, storytellers can stand and give a 50-minute presentation,
right.
But we tell you a lot of little stories.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you want a motivational speaker or regular, or just a speaker, it's a difference than a storyteller.
All right.
Because the storytelling giving you a story and then also a scenario around it.
All right. Ladies, I have to apologize that I didn't have my act together and had to explain to the audience. Okay. And there's a lot that we really didn't get a chance to get into, so I'm going to invite you back again. Okay. And mm-hmm. then we can get, and I might, I'll give you an assignment. All right.
Okay.
But if they wanted to kind of contact you, how would they go about doing that and all that kind of thing?
We can be contacted through the Detroit Association of Black Storytellers and
the Detroit Story League. Mm-hmm. However, I still would like to give my number, name
okay,
and number.
Yes, 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 yes.
My name, Gwendolyn Lewis. My telephone number, cell number is 313-467-9294.
Okay, and you're going to repeat that.
Cell number 313-467-9294. My email is G Lewis. The number at mi.rr.com.
Okay, Cheryl, is that the same for you or is it different?
It is. It's different for me.
Okay.
I am the CEO of Creative Literacy Concepts. My number is 248-979-2236.
Okay. And I want to thank both of you ladies again. And I want to let my listeners know that they will be back on. And we'll give them, I'm going to have my listeners send me some topics, okay?
Okay.
All right. This is Betty Daniels from Impact. Thank you very much and for joining us.
listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
You are at the malt shop with Daddy G. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop, where the jukebox is playing, the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.